This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Troublemaker, Surviving Hollywood and Scientology. This is the author, Leah Remini. Let me start with this. I'm an apostate. I have lied. I have cheated. I have done things in my life that I am not proud of, including but not limited to falling in love with a married man 19 years ago, being selfish and self-centered, fighting with virtually everyone I've ever known via hateful emails, texts, and spoken words, physically threatening people, from parking ticket meter maids to parents who hit their kids in public, not showing up at funerals of people I loved because I don't deal well with death, being on occasion a horrible daughter, mother, sister, aunt, stepmother, wife. This list goes on and on. The same goes for every single person in my family. My husband, also a serial cheater, sold drugs when he was young. My mother was a self-admitted slut in her younger days. We're talking the 1960s, before she got married. My dad sold cocaine and committed various other crimes and then served time at Rikers Island. Why am I revealing all this? Because after the Church of Scientology gets hold of this book, it may well spend an obscene amount of money running ads, creating websites, and trotting out celebrities to make public statements that their religious beliefs are being attacked, all in an attempt to discredit me by disparaging my reputation and that of anyone close to me. So let me save them some money. There is no shortage of people who would be willing to say, Leah can be an asshole. My own mother can attest to that. And if I am all these things, the church may claim, then isn't it also accurate to say that in the end, 30-plus years of dedication, millions of dollars spent, and countless hours of study and training didn't really fix me? Perhaps Scientology doesn't work? Since I left the Church of Scientology in 2013, I am often asked the question, how does someone like you get involved with an organization like Scientology? Or, some people may phrase it more like, how the fuck did you get into some crazy shit like this? Describing Scientology is no easy undertaking for anyone. There are plenty of people, many of whom are smarter than I am and have more formal education, who have worked to define and examine the church and the sway it holds over its members. This book, written from my heart and based on personal knowledge, is my attempt to portray my experience within Scientology and the repercussions I endured as a result. So while I may not be able to say in a few brief sentences why I became involved in Scientology and remained a member for decades, I can tell you that whether you were raised in the organization or came to it after falling out with your own religion, traditions, or family, the central tenet of Scientology, as stated by its founder, L. Ron Hubbard, LRH, is incredibly alluring. Scientology offers a clearly laid out scientific process that helps you to overcome your limitations and realize your full potential for greatness. It is presented as a well-defined path to achieving total spiritual freedom and enlightenment and a full understanding of yourself and others. LRH wrote that the aims of Scientology are a civilization without insanity, without criminals, and without war, where the able can prosper and honest beings can have rights, and where man is free to rise to greater heights. He went on to state, what is true for you is what you have observed yourself, and when you lose that, you have lost everything. As well as, don't take my word that Scientology works or doesn't work. Use it and see for yourself. Take what works and throw away the rest. I, along with many others, found these approaches to be hugely empowering. I was taken with the idea that a deep, systematic and straightforward wisdom on how to live the best life for myself and the planet could be presented before me in a direct, tangible, and comprehensive way. Through rigorous study and regular counseling, called auditing in Scientology, I could work toward the ultimate goal of going clear, meaning I would no longer be affected by the part of my mind ruled by pain and irrationality. This promise of a higher living and way of thinking drew me in, along with thousands of others who were looking for an alternative to therapy or more traditional self-help. I, like many current Scientologists, was a second-generation practitioner, meaning you were either born into Scientology or brought in by your parents as a child. When you are raised in the church, your whole life, each and every day, becomes all about the church, unlike members of other churches or synagogues who attend Sunday Mass or Shabbat dinner once a week. As a Scientologist, you are expected to spend a minimum of 2.5 hours a day, every day, 7 days a week, at church, studying, and/or in counseling. The same goes for your family, friends, and business associates. It's no wonder the indoctrination quickly sets up an us-against-them mentality. To leave, to question it, would mean leaving anything and everything you have ever known. And because you were raised in the church, your world consists almost exclusively of Scientologists. For those who are not born into the church or brought in as children, the attraction to join is most definitely there. Imagine you're struggling in your life, in your career, or you're maybe an actor with little or no fame. You walk into a Scientology church or a celebrity center, a Scientology church that caters specifically to artists. Having been enticed by an ad you read in a magazine about improving your life or career, you're impressed with the beautiful building and the welcoming people there. They offer you food, listen to what you have to say. Maybe you talk about how your parents are not supportive of your endeavors and they respond, "Wow, that's not cool. You can achieve your goals in life. Maybe you need to step away from your parents' negativity for a bit and do a course here that will help you to reach your goals." You feel vindicated. "This person understands me. He or she is my ally. This group believes in me." In the real world, you may feel like you were nothing, but here, you're treated with respect. The other aspect of Scientology that draws people in is the recognition the church bestows on its members for their donations. Let's say you're a successful business person. Where else would you be pulled up on stage with crowds cheering in admiration for the millions you have donated? You are doted on by the church at this level, recognized and made to feel special. Very enticing. Or what if you're someone who earns $45,000 a year? You're now going to be celebrated and acknowledged for your $2,000 contribution. Even if you have no money, the church will find a way for you to borrow it, with a framed certificate and calligraphy certifying your donation. This, in turn, again, makes you feel special. You believe you're doing great things for not only yourself, but for all of mankind. This type of celebration and recognition works on members of all levels. During my 30-plus years in Scientology, I spent close to $2 million for services and training and donated roughly $3 million to church causes. Most members, regardless of their income, over a lifetime in the church, spend upwards of $500,000 to get to the highest levels, which often takes more than 20 years. During this time, they are required to purchase roughly 300 books, 3,000 lectures, and 100 courses. Scientologists funnel their hard work, money, and emotional capital right back into the church, often to the detriment of their own lives. They may sacrifice relationships with family members, contact with friends, and their life savings to move up through the assigned spiritual levels that are dictated by the church's principles. They do this because they're indoctrinated with the belief that Scientology has the answers not only to their own ills, but to the ills of all humankind. I have no doubt that when this book comes out, Scientologists will scream about religious intolerance, say that I'm a liar, that I was kicked out of the church, and call troublemaker the work of a hateful bigot or self-absorbed person with an insatiable craving for attention. That last part might not be totally untrue. I am an actress after all. What they will likely not do, however, is actually read this book, because that would be going against one of the basic tenets of Scientology. A member should not read or watch anything generated by someone whom the church has declared a suppressive person, or SP, someone who in the church's eyes, and by LRH's policy, is found to be a threat to Scientology. Once the church has labeled you an SP, you are declared, and as a result, you are cut off from all practicing Scientologists. So, I've been declared by the church to be a suppressive person because I questioned, spoke out against, and refused to abide by the hypocrisy that had become my life. The church has lashed out at me in the press and will continue to do so. But the reality is that the church has benefited from me, my money, my time, my celebrity status, and my family. Everything I had dedicated myself to for all those years was taken away in an instant when I was declared an SP. I was the one left with the heartbreak of feeling that the unraveling of my faith and fate and life as I knew it was primarily influenced by two people. Tom Cruise, the church's most coveted celebrated and protected celebrity member, and David Miscavige, the tyrannical leader and current head of the church. Ironically for me and for most other people who have left the church and spoken out against it, the very qualities that we've been penalized for, defying, questioning, thinking independently, are the same qualities that made us prime candidates for Scientology in the first place. According to church policy, since I have been declared a suppressive person, all church members, including dozens of my closest friends and family, must disconnect from me, meaning cutting any and all ties. Though thankfully my mother, stepfather, sister, and brother-in-law have stood by me, no more contact ever. I am not the first to leave and speak out against Scientology. Many, like me, have questioned a faith that erratically labels its followers, constantly encourages its parishioners to donate their life savings and beyond to its coffers, kicks its followers out of a religion they have believed in and dedicated themselves to. It is to the Church of Scientology that I say this. I wrote this book because I feel an urgency and responsibility to reveal the injustices and hypocrisy that were perpetrated against those who left and spoke out before me. Those who again and again have been harassed and bullied into silence. This book is also a personal act of defiance against intolerance, which I have witnessed, lived with, and been part of for far too long. Chapter 1. As far back as I can remember, I was always performing and trying to make people laugh. I grew up on I Love Lucy, Welcome Back Kotter, Happy Days, Gilligan's Island, Three's Company, Sanford and Son, All in the Family, Good Times. All right, you get the idea. Watching all these shows always made me feel something. I knew early on that I wanted to make people feel the same way. As a kid, I was always putting on shows, recreating skits from the Carol Burnett Show and singing Donnie Marie songs in the living room. My older sister, Nicole, reluctantly played my sidekick, although she never had any enthusiasm for these skits and performances, she obliged. I also took to giving her notes, like, Nick, Donnie loves Marie, so when we do I'm a Little Bit Country, you gotta look at me like he looks at Marie with a smile and maybe a wink, she would respond with, or how about I just punch you in the face? Okay, we all make our choices as performers. When I was 9 years old, I heard that the Broadway musical Annie was holding open auditions for the lead role. I didn't let the fact that I had no singing talent or acting experience deter me. My mom supported me, believing that I would one day be an actress, and she got a playwright friend to teach me the song Tomorrow and take me to the group audition. Her boyfriend at the time photographed me for my headshots, in which I wore my very best Little House on the Prairie shirt. When I got the pictures back, I was seriously floored on how beautiful I looked. Clearly, the Annie people would see this little gem from Brooklyn and want to hire me on the spot, but I was still willing to sing for them if need be. The audition was a cattle call, which meant everyone was assigned a number and sat in the audience section of a huge theater until that number was called. The image running through my mind was that of a front page headline in the New York Post, Brooklyn girl with no experience nabs Annie role. Whatever I lacked in terms of dancing or singing, someone could teach me. I had the chutzpah to land the part, and as for my long straight brown hair, well, that's what wigs were for. And with that, I was off to hand the director my picture. But as soon as my name was called, and I got on stage facing the director and all those people sitting in the darkened theater, I went blind with panic. The pianist hit a key, and I started to sing immediately. The, no, that's for the key. The director interrupted. Okay, well, maybe you should tell people. Do you want me to start again? I said. That's okay. Go home to mommy, the director said as he looked down at his clipboard. I burst into tears before I had even gotten off the stage. I was crying the way kids do when they can't catch their breath. My mom's friend, the one who taught me the song, who had brought me to the audition, took me for a slice of pizza and an Italian ice over which we discussed how that director would regret not hiring me and how Annie would bomb without me. The Broadway show Annie would suffer and suffer big without me in it. When I wasn't acting out my favorite TV shows, Nicole and I could be found hanging out on 86th Street near Bay Parkway, where loud music thumped from the cars to get girls' attention. even though the guys in their gold chains, Old Spice, and gelled hair acted like they were too cool to care, I aspired to be one of those girls whose attention the guys sought. Tight Jordache and Sergio Valente jeans with a brush jammed in the back pocket. Lots of makeup and aquanet and even more attitude. All they ever seemed to do was hang out on the corner, like a hooker, but not, and I wanted in. I vowed that when I was older, maybe 12 or 13, I would be just like them. This was Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, circa 1980. We talked tough, but ultimately it was a protective neighborhood for those who belonged. When a car alarm went off, there would be five Joeys and Frankies out on the street with bats within 2 minutes. There was no such thing as minding your own business. If a boyfriend was fighting with his girlfriend, another guy would start yelling, "Yo, you don't fucking talk to a girl like that." Enough said. When we were kids, our neighborhood basically consisting of a bakery, a pizzeria, a bagel store, a Baskin-Robbins, a Chock Full of Nuts, a Te Amo, and an Optima was our whole universe. While Manhattan, just a quick train ride away, was foreign to Nicole and me, places like Long Island and New Jersey were another planet. When our mom took us to the Poconos for vacation, a rarity, we met a group of girls who asked us if we wanted to help collect things for a collage. First, we had to clear up what a collage was because my sister and I didn't speak French. When it rained, these kids stayed inside and played Atari, unlike us Brooklyn kids who were used to hanging out in front of the candy store come rain, sleet, or mini hurricane. Our regular neighborhood haunt was the local Te Amo convenience store near the D train. We could also be found at other people's houses where it seemed there was always better toys and better food than at ours. I spent a lot of time at my friend's place above our apartment at Bay Parkway. She had a Barbie dream house, which back then, to little girls, was pretty much the equivalent of crack. That's where I was playing one day when my mom called Nicole and me down to share some news. "I gotta tell you girls something," Mom said. "Your dad and I are separating. I don't want you to be upset. I'm okay, and we're gonna be okay." I sat there basically without expression and looked at my sister, wondering if I should try to fake being more upset. George, my dad, was a classic paisan of Sicilian origin who used hairspray on his remaining three hairs, wore a rope chain and a pinky ring, got his nails done, and kept his car, Cadillac of course, perfectly clean and smelling good with one of those scented trees that hang from the rearview mirror. And I was scared shitless of the man. He never hit me. Nicole, on the other hand, would get smacked. "You were older, you should know better," he used to say to my sister as if she was going to college already, though she was just a year older than me. What terrified me was the way my dad could annihilate you when he spoke, throwing around words like idiot, retard, moron at the drop of a hat. One time when we were little and pretending to make soup in the bathroom sink out of his Old Spice contact, cold capsules, and most of the other contents of the medicine cabinet, I saw my dad at the end of the hallway. When he asked, "What the fuck are yous doing?" I got hot all over and I couldn't say a word. After Nicole answered, "We're making a soup," he spanked her. For some reason, I always laugh when my sister got hit. I'm sure it was a defense against more complicated emotions, or I was just evil as a kid and liked her getting hit. "Idiots," he said. "Get into your room." He was only raising us the way he had been raised, but any time he was around, I was tense. Even when he was trying to be kind. For example, one time when I came to the dinner table, I found a paper bag on my chair, so I didn't sit down. "What are you going to do, stand there?" he asked, looking at me. "What's the right answer?" I didn't want to say the wrong thing, so I didn't say anything. "Pick up the bag, idiot," my dad said. Thinking this was some kind of trick, I nervously picked up the bag and opened it. Inside was a doll. By the time I realized what it was, however, I was so wound up that I had started to cry. "What's with you?" Dad started yelling. "Someone tries to give you a gift and you're crying?" I couldn't catch my breath to explain. I remember once when I carelessly shoved a box of cookies into the kitchen cabinet, my dad walked by, saw what I was doing, and said, "What kind of fucking animal puts cookies back this way?" He grabbed the box and threw the cookies across the room. I responded by giving him the cold shoulder. An hour later, I went into the living room to get a blanket, and there was my dad sitting on the couch watching TV. He smiled at me and gave me a nod. Again, I ignored him. "Why, you mad at me? You mad at Daddy? You're not talking to me? Come sit down and watch a movie with me." Before long, my resolve melted, and I sat down and cuddled up next to him. I fell for it every time. When he wasn't yelling and calling us names, my dad could be charming, loving, protective. Everything you would want a dad to be. Everything that would draw me in. He had a big personality, and when he was around, he would take over the room and everyone else would seem to disappear. Try as I might to resist him, time and time again, I couldn't. When it was just my mom, it was like a different world. Vicky was a fun, free spirit, kind of like a hippie. She didn't believe in sugar, and she wore her hair parted down the middle with barrettes holding it back on the sides, but she always had a look, like she was a little bit of trouble. There were not a whole lot of rules with her. She was an only child, and her mother and father, who were Jewish, died when she was very young, so she was sent to live with an aunt who made it very clear that she hated my mother. Because Mom didn't have structure or a traditional mother in her own childhood, she never learned that role, nor did she want to. Although she was a stay-at-home mom, she wasn't a big cook. She didn't make her own sauce like the Italian moms did, or rice and beans like the moms of my Puerto Rican friends. Dinner at our house was anything you could coat in egg and 4C breadcrumbs and fry. That and salad with way too much vinegar. No one wanted to come to my house after school because we didn't have Twinkies, Devil Dogs, Oreos, or anything else good to eat. Once after playing Charlie's Angels on the playground at school, I invited my friends over. But when they got there, all I could say was, "Hey, anyone up for Wheat Thins? No? We have tab? No? Okay." That was about when someone would suggest that we go to hang out at my friend Roberta's house. I didn't blame them. Roberta's apartment was everything that a household should look like, smell like, and essentially be. It came complete with plastic slipcovers over the furniture to protect it and a special case to house her mother's Norman Rockwell figurines. I was convinced that this was what a home was supposed to be like, and this was definitely not how we were rolling. When I asked my mom why we didn't have plastic on our furniture like Roberta did, she said, "You want your ass to stick to the couch?" Yes. And I wanted her to have the lemony smell of Pledge in the house. That's right, the wood cleaner. All my friends had to pledge all the wood furniture in their houses on the weekends, and I wanted to do the same. I also wanted my mom to iron my clothes for school, putting a crease down the middle of my pants like the other girls' pants had. Instead, Mom showed me where the iron was and told me how to use it. I was obsessed with how I thought things should be and appear. I think on some level, every kid wants what other kids have, but I was particularly status conscious. It was in my DNA to constantly scan my surroundings, always observing, always making mental notes of the details that would make me the right kind of person. And if I couldn't be this right kind of person with the right kind of things, I would be quick to criticize myself before anyone else could. And I would often bark out to my mother, "Why don't we have this? And why don't we have that?" Collecting things, creases in my pants, plastic covers, pledged dining room tables. This is how you are accepted, I thought. But I was never able to achieve or find the normalcy I craved. I felt subpar to all my friends. Even those friends who lived in the projects had moms who spent their days at home cooking delicious vats of rice and beans while I was left to eat the two-day-old bagel. Because of my obsession with appearances, I was skeptical at first of my mom's boyfriend, Dennis, whom she brought home when I was 7 years old, after she had divorced my dad. In comparison to my dad, Dennis was a bit of a geek, with his glasses, pants belted high up on his waist and mustache, but he was also very sweet and didn't make me feel tense when he was around like my dad did. Dennis immediately put Nick and me at ease when he gave us the speech. "Not trying to be your dad. You already have one of those. Look at me as a friend. I love your mother, and I will love you." My sister and I liked his spirit, but we were going to have to work on his look, starting with getting a little dippity-doo into that hair. Dennis was easygoing and playful, just like my mom. They would do things like have water fights where they'd run into our room to use Nick and me as human shields while they tried to throw cupfuls of water at each other. Even though he was Italian, Dennis wasn't anything like any of the other guys we knew. He didn't seem to have man hang-ups or the macho mentality that most of the men I grew up with had. He was a waiter and a great cook, and he always made us food whenever he was home. "Your mother's not going to cook a decent meal ever for you girls," he joked, "so you better be nice to me." He didn't dismiss us or try to shoo us away like everyone else in the neighborhood did. Instead, he looked us right in the eye and took everything we said seriously, even though we were just kids. Mom said it was because he was a Scientologist. I didn't know what that meant, some kind of scientist maybe, and I didn't really care either. At least not until my mother started going to the city by herself and not coming back until late at night. "Where do you go, Ma?" I asked one night over chicken cutlets at the kitchen table when it seemed like it had been forever since she'd been home for dinner. "I go to this church," she said. "But aren't you Jewish?" I asked. The only church I knew of was the Catholic one that we often attended with my grandmother, my father's mother, who lived in Little Italy. "This is the Church of Scientology. This church isn't about God and saints. It's about helping you to live your life better. Like the course I'm doing now, I'm learning that if you do something bad, even if it's little, if you're a good person, you feel bad about it. And what happens is that in your mind, that little thing becomes a big thing. And that leads to you feeling bad about yourself, which then leads to doing more bad things. All these bad things, no matter how small, are called overts. And if you don't get those overts off, you will do worse things. But if you tell the truth about what you've done," she continued, "you kind of clear the slate, and then you don't feel like you have to do more bad things. This is what's called in Scientology getting off your overts, like confessing your sins, but more practical. That's why you should tell me anything you girls have done that I don't know about." As soon as my mom said that, I thought about the operation I had come up with to feed my leg warmer addiction. After seeing Flashdance, I decided I needed leg warmers in every color. I was always about quantity rather than quality. I told the neighborhood boys I'd give a hickey to anyone who stole leg warmers from me from the Chinese vendors. At the time, hickeys were a big deal. It was a sign that you were up to some stuff. We practiced them on ourselves, on our upper arms. This way you could just pull down your sleeves and nobody would know you'd been practicing on yourself. When it came to my trading hickeys for leg warmers, I was very specific about just what it was going to take to get me to put my lips on a boy's neck. We're talking a minimum of 3 pairs, preferably purple, purple with glitter, and light purple. It was a brilliant idea, if I do say so myself. So here I was at the dinner table wanting to do what my mom was asking, tell the truth, but if I did that, she was no doubt going to kill me. "Ma," I said, "I didn't personally steal anything." "Leah, what did you do?" "I might have said I would give someone a hickey if they got me leg warmers from the Chinese vendors." "Ew," Nicole said. Normally, I would have told Nicole to shut up, but I was stealing myself for the more important reaction from my mom. The reaction of most moms I knew would be a crack in the mouth. Who tells their mother the truth? No one. That's who. All kids know this. I assumed I'd be punished in some serious way for the leg warmer hickey racket. This was the test. "Thank you for telling me," my mom said. I waited for the catch, but there was none. Instead, she showed me the precepts about stealing and said, "I know you know the difference between right and wrong, and I just want you to make better decisions for yourself." What is this magic happening before me? I looked at her, looked at my sister, back to my chicken cutlet, back to my mom, back to my plate, hoping the carrots disappeared, but they didn't. That was okay. A miracle was still occurring. It was like the clouds parted, and a ray of light came shining down on me. Even for someone as lenient as my mom, this was unheard of. On top of not receiving any kind of punishment for the leg warmer fence, I suddenly felt like I went from being a kid to being someone capable of making my own decisions. The sense of power and superiority was exciting. No, I didn't have sugar cereals or arroz con pollo on the stove, but damn it, I had acquired some serious grown-up power. "Nicole is making out with boys when you're not here," I added. "I'm going to kick your ass," Nicole yelled at me. "Well, you're not giving up anything. You have to be honest. I'm just saying." "Okay, Leah," my mom said, "you don't need to give up other people's transgressions and stop with the bread, eat your carrots." I liked a religion where I didn't get in trouble for stealing leg warmers, but I didn't like that my mom was hardly ever home because she was at the church. Does that book say anything about kids being home alone, about you leaving early in the morning for the church and not coming home until late, I said. "Well," mom said, "if you don't want to be here by yourself, come meet me in the city after school and check out the church." She didn't have to ask me and my sister twice. The next day, Nicole and I met at the subway and took the B train into the city for the first time by ourselves. As we walked up the stairs to the elevated subway track, I was fearful, but I was comforted by having my sister at my side. On the train, I felt less secure. Graffiti was everywhere, and a guy was slumped in the corner. Everything was filthy. We hadn't even arrived in the city yet, and already it was so different from Bensonhurst. There were no friends here, no Joeys or Frankies. Nobody was looking out for us. We got off at Times Square, which back then was basically the worst place in the world for two young girls, but we were headed to the New York Org, the main place where people studied and did other activities central to Scientology and where my mom was working on staff. By the time we arrived at the building on 46th Street between 6th and 7th Avenues, we had passed so many leering men and triple X-rated places that the big building, which looked like a bank or a theater and had a hanging metal awning that read Church of Scientology of New York, really did seem like a church or a refuge. Despite how freaked out we were about going into the city that first time, Nick and I started going all the time after school, on weekends, and all summer. We were on course at the New York Org, which meant we were doing one of the 20 Scientology life improvement courses that deal with all parts of life, from finance to family. We were told that L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, developed Discoveries of Existence, which give you the know-how to overcome ups and downs, to know who you can trust, to organize your life, to achieve your goals, and much more. My sister and I were twinning, which meant we took all our introductory courses together and teamed up for the drills you have to do on the course. And one of our first was a cornerstone of Scientology, the Success Through Communication course. The point of the course was straightforward enough. It was going to teach us how to talk to people better. I was all for that. My mouth was always getting me into trouble. The drills that we did in a room with other kids and adults on all different courses were called training routines, or TRs. During the first one, OTTR0, Operating Thetan Confronting, Thetan in Scientology means spirit, Nick and I had to keep our eyes closed and sit there across from each other. We often used that as a chance to get a nap in, but our supervisor came over and told us that wasn't the purpose of the drill. When we got good at that, sitting without moving or falling asleep, we moved on to sitting across from each other with our eyes open. If one of us moved our big toe or looked down for a split second, the other had to say, flunk. Then we both start all over again. The goal was to be able to sit and confront another person comfortably without feeling the need to speak or do anything else other than look at the human being in front of you. Also, part of the communication course is a training routine called TR0 Bullbait, where the coach focuses on doing whatever it takes to get a reaction from your twin, called push the other person's buttons. The goal of the trainee is to not show any emotion or any reaction at all, no matter what is thrown at him or her. If you speak, roll your eyes, cry, laugh, or even blush, you are met with a flunk. Like most girls, I was always self-conscious about my appearance, whether I had a pimple, if my nails were dirty, you name it. Nicole, being my older sister, knew all this, and there was no one better at getting under my skin. What's that on your face? Nicole said during my bullbait session. Are you growing something there? I instinctively touched my forehead. Flunk, Nicole said. Nick did it again and again until it no longer bothered me. Well, until not a trace of emotion showed on my face. It bothered me, but I couldn't show it if I wanted to pass the drill and move on. My sister had it a lot tougher when it was her turn. A male supervisor, who was probably in his 20s at the time, but seemed about 50 to me, tested her. You have big tits for such a young girl, he said to Nicole to see if she would pass the drill and get her TRs in. Fuck you, she said. Flunk! You have big tits for a young girl, he repeated. I'm telling my mother. Flunk, he said. Learn to confront what's happening in front of you and be above it. You are not a body, Nicole. You're a spiritual being. He didn't stop until Nicole, too, didn't react any longer. Our being on course made Mom, who by this point was working full-time for the church, really happy. After school and on weekends, Nick and I would do a course, which would take a minimum of 2.5 hours a day and run on average for a week or two, but then we'd have to wait around for about 7 hours until Mom was done working. So we spent a lot of time distributing church pamphlets. Passers-by would sometimes yell things like, you're too young to be in a fucking cult, and running the streets, dodging in and out of random buildings, which sometimes got us in trouble. We didn't meet too many kids at the New York Org, although I remember one girl named Sherry, who was my age but appeared a lot older, could have been the cup of coffee she was holding, whom my mom introduced me to in the lobby there. She was in the Sea Org, and because of her specific location and duty, she was required to wear a uniform of a white shirt and blue pants. I was no doubt dressed in my tight jeans and a shirt that said Leah, and of course I had perfectly feathered hair and gold chains. I looked at her outfit and asked her, what are you wearing? I work here, and this is my uniform, she said. Wait, he was a girl my age who worked at the same place as my mother? Here I am running around like a dopey kid, and here's this girl with a uniform and a coffee cup? I thought she was super cool. After we started taking introductory courses, we were encouraged to also start participating in introductory auditing, a form of one-on-one counseling using the e-meter, an electronic device that claims to measure thought and emotion. A Scientology practitioner asked the person being counseled specific questions, and using readings on the e-meter directs them to talk about points of emotional discomfort or upset until they are relieved. Children as young as 7 can participate in auditing. Both of those practices of being on course and auditing are the two required paths to move up the bridge to total freedom, which represents various states of spirituality. Scientology was our life, not just in the New York org, but also back home in Brooklyn, where our moms started adapting the training routines to everyday scenarios. If Nick and I got into a physical fight over, let's say, whether to watch Solid Gold or Fantasy Island, Mom would shout, "You guys do TR0," which meant we had to sit and look at each other until we loved each other again. Sometimes it took a while. The whole idea of not reacting to other people, no matter what they said, was such a foreign concept where I came from. In our neighborhood, everything was an opportunity to get in someone's face. Bensonhurst people didn't hold back. But the fact that Scientology offered a different way of living was exactly the point, according to my mom, who wanted more for us than what Bensonhurst offered. I understood that Scientology was about following the precepts laid down in the policy by the leader L. Ron Hubbard. If you did that, your life would be good. But if you committed overts or transgressions and didn't talk about them, didn't take Scientology courses in auditing, then you would receive something bad back from the universe. And the only way to really do things right for yourself in the universe was to stay connected to the church. I never met LRH, the popular sci-fi writer who founded the church in 1952 and died in 1986. Still, he made a huge impression on me. The first time I walked into the New York org, I was struck by the big bronze bust of him. He looked like a god, or at least someone standing in judgment. There were pictures of him everywhere, and he was always standing behind a big desk or writing something that looked like it had to be important. I felt pretty special. Everyone was telling me that I wasn't a kid, but a spiritual being with past lives, and that we were all on the same mission to clear the planet, to eradicate insanity, war, and crime across the whole world, and create a peaceful earth by helping all beings free themselves with Scientology. I was told that I was now a part of an elite and important group who were the only ones doing anything about the planet. I decided that this man was going to know me. There was a little locked wooden box with a pen and paper so that you could write messages and leave them directly for LRH. "Hi, Ron, my name is Leah," I wrote by way of introducing myself. "I am doing a communication course with my sister." Shortly afterward, I got a letter back. It was typed out on a clean white piece of paper, folded perfectly, and at the bottom it said, "Love, Ron." Not a stamp, but his actual signature. This was proof. I was special. In general, I was now starting to grow used to and liking how the adults at the New York org treated me with respect, which was so different than back in Brooklyn, where I was nothing more than an annoying kid. Scientologists praised me and my sister for finding our way back. I was a grown-up to them. Scientology was so very powerful to me as a child because finally, after feeling subpar for so long because I never had the right clothes, apartment, furniture, food, toys, you name it, I now had something on other people. Traveling to the city, taking responsibility for my actions, working on my communication skills, all contributed to my sense of superiority. I could do things my friends couldn't, like steal leg warmers without getting in trouble, because now I had this technology and they didn't. I used words like affinity, which as a kid was pretty awesome, or "you don't have to yell, just communicate," I would say to my friends' mothers. They were impressed that I could use a multi-syllable word. My dad, however, wasn't so impressed. After he moved out of our apartment, He moved into a big house with Donna, the woman who became my stepmom. My sister and I spent weekends there with him and Donna, and then their two daughters, Elizabeth and Stephanie, and Donna's daughter, Christina. During visits to my dad's, more often than not, he would complain about my mother. "Does your mother ever brush your hair?" he said, looking at me. "What are you, homeless? Doesn't your mother take care of you, or is she too busy with that cult?" Now that I had been doing my communication course, I was going to get my TRs in to confront him. So over dinner with Nick and my stepfamily, all seated around a huge table covered with the best whipped potatoes, corn salad, and warm Italian bread with butter, I summoned the courage to take on my dad. "I don't think you should be talking about my mother," I said in a voice that was a little less assured than I had hoped for. "What? I don't want you talking about my mother." "Or what?" "Well, no, or. I just don't want you to, it's like, not nice. You don't come into my fucking house and tell me what's nice." The heat in my body rose so quickly I wanted to crawl into my own face. Whenever my dad spoke in that tone, it always felt like being slapped. "Don't react. Don't react. Remember Bull Bait, Leah. Dad, I really think it's better if you just communicate with us without putting us or our mother down." "Oh, is that what we should do? We should communicate? Is that what Elrond told you to say?" He was laughing now, and despite my best efforts to keep it together, I started to lose confidence in what I was saying and how I was saying it. Why couldn't my dad treat me like an equal the way people at the church did? Why couldn't he value me as someone who had something to say? These were the kinds of exchanges that proved what Scientology was teaching us. That people who don't get the ideals of Scientology are not as able or not as healthy and mentally sound as we are and will attack it. And now I believed that was right. It was us against them. It was around this time that the Sea Organization recruiters came to talk to my mom and Dennis and us girls. The Sea Organization was founded by L. Ron Hubbard in 1967 to staff his three ships, on which he'd taken up residence after the UK denied his visa extension. He wanted to live outside the jurisdiction of any governments and away from the media, and he said he was continuing research. He produced the OT levels on the ships. These levels, OT is short for Operating Thetan, are the secret advanced levels of the Scientology bridge that you move on to only after you achieve the state of clear. Originally, the people with him were sailors, brought on to keep the ships running. The crews then started taking on more functions within Hubbard's Sea Org, and the main ship Apollo grew into a center for training Scientology staff from around the world. Subsequently, those people who were with Hubbard and the Sea Organization were entrusted with the highest level functions, secrets, and control of Scientology internationally, tasked with clearing the planet through multiple lives as they were reincarnated over and over for all of eternity. The Sea Org continues to be made up of the most devout and dedicated Scientologists, a clergy of sorts who work for the church and are held to the highest standards within the organization. Although there are no official numbers, I have heard that there are close to 4,000 Sea Organization members in the United States and roughly 20,000 Scientology parishioners total. So roughly one in five members tends to be in the Sea Org. The church claims to have roughly 10 million parishioners worldwide, but this number apparently includes anyone who has ever bought a book, taken a course, or entered a church building. Estimates of the actual worldwide members are closer to 35,000. The recruiters told Mom and Dennis, "This is the best thing for you, for the planet. You have a responsibility. Look at your girls. What are they doing? They're going down the wrong path. They're hanging around bad people. A criminal element. What kind of life is that?" By this time, I was going through a combo package, Run DMC Puerto Rican phase, where I wore only Adidas, had a mullet, sang Menudo songs, even though I didn't speak Spanish, and hung out in Cropsey Park with a bunch of breakdancers. At least that's what I thought they were. As it turned out, they were also part-time drug dealers, but I didn't know about that. Back then, everybody carried a fanny pack. The recruiters preyed on my mom's concern for us to have a better life and her devotion to the religion. They said, "Your girls can do what they want to do in the Sea Org. Leah can act right away in the Scientology movies, and Nicole can train to be a lawyer for the church. The planet is going downhill. Your help is needed. And in the end, what will be your answer to this question? Did you help?" Mom and Dennis had already committed themselves to Scientology, bought it hook, line, and sinker, and now they were told they needed to do more. So not only would we be saving the planet, as Scientology dictates, but we'd also be doing the things we loved. And Mom and Dennis could move up the bridge for free. This was provided only to Sea Org members. And with no distractions from the outside world, plus no more paying bills, as the Sea Org would provide us with housing, food, clothing, it was all just too good to be true. Who can blame Mom and Dennis for signing us all up for that? Chapter 2. By the time Nicole, Mom, and I got off the plane in Tampa, it was 2 a.m, and I was exhausted but excited. I was leaving home for something big. I had already made huge sacrifices, like leaving behind my Smurf collection. But that's what you do when you are on a mission to clear the planet. We are headed to the Gulf Coast city of Clearwater, Florida, the mecca of Scientology, otherwise known as FLAG, a carryover from the Sea Org term flagship, which itself was a carryover from Hubbard's ships when he moved back to land in 1975. We had come there to get the whole planet up to clear, the goal of Scientology. Clear is the state on the bridge that you achieve through Scientology auditing when you no longer have a reactive mind, which is defined as the hidden source of irrational behavior, unreasonable fears, upsets, and insecurities. The bridge is the route or guide to each higher state. As the Scientology literature states, one walks it and one becomes free. It would be a fresh start for all of us, including Mom and Dennis, who are now married and expecting a baby in 3 months. Dennis had stayed back in Brooklyn to deal with getting rid of everything in our apartment and to accumulate more money, knowing that we wouldn't be making much after this point. He planned to join us in a few weeks. While on the plane, I had imagined the welcome we would get when we landed. I pictured men in suits waiting for us at the gate. "Ron has been expecting you," one would say to me before handing me a freshly pressed military uniform. Then they'd lead us to a stretch limousine with tinted windows. I wasn't sure if Scientology had a flag, but if there was one, it'd be flying from the hood. Instead, the airport was pretty much deserted upon our arrival, aside from a guy working a floor buffer. We made our way down to baggage claim, where I took my suitcase and Nicole took the other two since my mother was pregnant. Mom kept looking around as if someone she expected to be there was missing. Nicole and I followed her out of the terminal. Once we got outside, Mom looked left, then right, and her worried expression began to scare me. "Ma, is anyone going to pick us up?" I asked, but she ignored me and walked back to the airport, where she found a payphone. She fished out a quarter and made a call, but no one on the other end picked up. Nicole and I shot each other a look and stayed quiet. Mom tried calling again. This time she let it ring for a long, long time until someone finally picked up. "Where are you?" she yelled. "I don't have money for a cab." "Okay, fine, I'll get one now, but somebody better be there to pay for it." After a half-hour drive, we arrived at the Fort Harrison, a historic hotel that had fallen into disrepair before L. Ron Hubbard bought it in 1975, with the idea of turning Clearwater into the spiritual headquarters for all of Scientology. The large, old-school lobby looked like the kind you see in movies, horror movies. There were marble staircases that descended to a large room with soaring columns, iron chandeliers, a black and white checkered floor, and creepy chairs that looked like they belonged in Dracula's castle. It was dead quiet until Mom started hitting the bell on the front desk. No one was there to receive us. When someone did finally show up, we were escorted to a cabana room near the pool. We were allowed to stay here among paying parishioners until space opened up for us at what was to become our regular berthing or housing for members of the Sea Org. We were among Scientologists who had flown in from all over the country to do their services and or upper OT levels, those above clear on the bridge. Eventually, we moved 30 minutes away from the Fort Harrison to what would be our new home. We pulled into what looked like a deserted motel. It was a Quality Inn. The motel housed Sea Org members and some staff who worked at the Fort Harrison and surrounding orgs or churches. This Quality Inn was running very low on quality. It was shabby, disgusting, and depressing. The pool we passed on the way to our room was literally a swamp. The Sea Org member who was showing us around said to my mom, "Vicky, you come with us and the girls are going to the girls' dorm." The only way you could get your own room was if you were married or had a baby. My mom's room was in the back of the motel while we were in the front. Our room, one that would normally accommodate one double bed, was crammed with 3 bunk beds, which slept 6 girls. In our tight, acid-wash jeans, crop shirts, mullets, Nick wearing a puka shell necklace, and me with a rope chain featuring a charm that read Little Brat, We definitely didn't look like any Scientologists they knew. After we walked into our room and over to our beds, one of the girls said, you're not allowed to wear perfume. You might want to do something about that. I can't breathe. Another girl on the far right top bunk blew the smoke away from her cigarette like it was bothering her, even though she was the one smoking. It took a second, but then I remembered. The girl from the New York Court! She looked at me tentatively, but in another instant, I could see she remembered me too. Sherry jumped off her bunk and gave me a hug. From there, we were shown the galley, which is where we were to report if we wanted meals. They served breakfast from 6 to 7:15 only. The floors were sticky with old food and the plates so slick with grease that my egg slid right off and onto the filthy parquet below. I held out my plate for more eggs, but the cook said, "Get out of my line and learn to get in present time." And just like that, I wasn't going to eat. Later, we met my mom at the recruitment office. The head of recruitment put down on the desk a white piece of paper with two seahorses flanking the words, "See Organization Contract of Employment." "You have to sign a contract to be here," the officer said. I looked at the contract and was baffled. I was asked to pledge myself for an eternal commitment to the Sea Org for 1 billion years in order to bring ethics to the whole universe. In accordance with Scientology beliefs, members are expected to return to the Sea Org when they are reborn over time in multiple lives. "Mom, we gotta sign this?" "Yes, you have to sign it." "Nick, are you going to be here in 1 billion years? "Yeah," she said. "Are you?" "Oh, definitely. What are you going to look like? Really fucking old." We both started laughing, but Mom shot us a look. Then we both signed. Ironically, even though she was promised by the recruiters that she could become a member of the Sea Org, my mother, who at this time had been affiliated with the church, worked for it, and been on course for a few years, didn't qualify for the organization because she had done LSD over a decade ago. After we signed our billion-year contracts, Nicole and I were put on the EPF, the Estates Project Force, part of the basic Sea Org training for new recruits. It was a lot like boot camp. All EPFers spent 12 hours a day doing hard labor, like pulling up tree roots with our bare hands, working heavy machinery on the grounds of the Fort Harrison and the Sandcastle, or cleaning bathrooms and hotel rooms. Then for 2.5 hours each day, we would do the basic courses for the EPF, in which you learn the Sea Org policies and rules, and what it meant to be a member. We were all given detailed check sheets, which listed all the actions we needed to take in order to complete each course. The first course being how to study Scientology. In studying the policies, we quickly learned that there is no middle ground or room for interpretation. Any question we asked was answered with, "What does LRH say?" You couldn't ask your supervisor for help other than, "Where can I find the policy that says what I do here?" If you disagreed with something, the supervisor would answer that with, "Okay, well, let's see what you don't understand here." Once, as a requirement during my coursework, my supervisor gestured toward a demo kit, one of which was located on every student's study table. It was a little basket filled with everyday objects like paper clips and chess and checker pieces. My supervisor told me to physically act out the sexual policy for Sea Org members with the objects in the kit, in a room filled with other trainees, some reading, others doing drills. "By using these things here, show me what the sexual policy is," the supervisor said. Policy stated it was forbidden for Sea Org members to have sex or physical contact of any kind before marriage. So I took a paperclip and a chess piece to stand for the girl and boy and rub them together saying, "This is not allowed." Then I had the girl and boy touching each other side by side. "This is not allowed." I put the girl and boy on opposite sides of the demo kit basket and said, "This is allowed." The supervisor took my check sheet and signed it so that I can move on to the next assignment. One day while I was working, Mike Curley, an older man who was the head of the EPF, singled me out right away. He was tall and gaunt, reminding me of a cowboy from the movies. "You're a little troublemaker, huh?" he said. "I don't know. I've been told that," I replied, trying to be cute. "I can tell you right now, you will address me as Yes, Sir, or No, Sir, or Mr. Curly, nothing else." "Oh, right, yeah, okay." "Not, oh, right, right, sir." Nicole chimed in to say, "We don't know the rules here." "Well, you're going to have to figure them out because I'm putting you in charge of the Sandcastle Hotel crew," he said, looking at me. "Me? I was all of 13. Again, in Scientology, children and adults are viewed equally. So it wasn't odd to them that I might be in charge of some adults on my watch as well. I now had responsibilities that no teenager back in Brooklyn could imagine. I was learning something here in this weird environment that combined lots of freedom and lots of structure. Yeah, they made us do hard labor all day, but I was no longer being treated like a child. I rose to the occasion and did the job I was tasked with, and came up with a plan to reward my crew. If we got the sandcastle cleaned in half the time, with good feedback from the guests via questionnaires they filled out, then the next day we could spend the other half of the day sitting on our asses at the pool. I was a boss running a crew, and I was going to make some serious executive decisions. And I had read on my course that you reward good work. In my mind, I was taking my orders directly from LRH. With the incentive of possible time off, the crew was motivated to clean better and faster. We got positive feedback from the guests and headed to the sandcastle's pool after we finished cleaning. We were all lying by the pool when Mike Curley walked by. He did a double take when he saw us. "What the hell are you doing?" he said, his face turning a deep shade of red. The thought that I might need to clear my plan with anybody hadn't even crossed my mind. I considered myself an executive of the Sea Org now. "I've read the policy. Get up, clean up all these deck chairs, and meet me at the dock," he said, then stormed off. When we got down to the marina, Mike was waiting for us in a motorboat. After we crammed into the small boat, he started driving out to the marina and into the bay, into the real ocean. He was dead silent, his eyes and his weather-beaten face staring out at the horizon until we were so far out that the marina was no longer visible. Then he cut the engine and started screaming at me. "Never do you sit in a public place. You are Sea Org members. Don't you know that the pool at that hotel is for paying guests only, not for you to be enjoying? Do you understand me?" he yelled. Actually, he was shouting so loud that I almost couldn't decipher what he was saying. Was he even speaking English? I wasn't sure. "Mm-hmm," I said. "It's yes, sir." I thought I was following LRH and rewarding my team, and I didn't know who these paying Scientology people were, but I was a Sea Org member and a bad motherfucker from Brooklyn clearing the planet. So just like I practiced with Nicole back home, I pushed down my emotions, got my TRs in, and I stayed silent. I mean, maybe Mike didn't know that LRH had written me personally and that I had come back from another life. Hello? Mike kept trying to get me to say, "Yes, sir," but I couldn't do it. Then he picked me up, and before I even realized what was happening, he threw me overboard. The shock of the moment and the freezing water took my breath away, and for an instant I thought I was going to drown, but I sputtered and began frantically dog paddling. "Yes, sir," Mike shouted. I couldn't do it. The words just wouldn't come out. Once I gathered myself, I became calm. The waves were choppy, but I was okay. I could swim. I began to tread water. This had become a battle as far as I was concerned, although I wasn't sure if I would win. Mike, who was following a policy practiced by LRH called overboarding, which entails throwing a crew member overboard as a form of reprimand, picked me up by my shirt again, but this time it was to pull me back into the boat. We returned to the marina in silence. I was soaking wet and humiliated at what had happened, but there was a part of me that thought that deep down, Mike Curley might just respect me for not backing down. A few weeks after we moved to Flag, we went back up to New York to see my father. Shortly after we arrived, as we were sitting around the kitchen table, he asked, "What are you doing there in Florida?" "I'm a housekeeper," I said. "Your mother moved you to the cult to be a housekeeper?" "Well, yeah, we clean hotel rooms that people pay money to stay in." "You're learning to clean hotel rooms? That's what you're learning?" "Well, yeah, but we just got there. It's part of basic training." I started getting flushed. I felt the need to defend my position and what we were doing to help clear the planet, but I was not able to present it to him the right way and ended up ultimately doing the work a disservice. "How much are you making?" he asked. $15 a week. "Donna," he yelled to my stepmom, "get me the help wanted section from the paper." He found an ad and showed it to me. "You see this? $125 a week for a housekeeper, and you're making a lousy $15. "Well, Dad, they're giving us room and board," I said, once again trying to defend it, but ultimately it was no use. He was convinced that he was right, and he felt the need to belittle me and what I believed in to prove it. Little did he know that by attacking Scientology, he ended up simply pushing me back into its arms. Them against us, I thought. This guy has no idea that I'm fighting for his eternity. We returned to Florida, and I have to admit, Dad pointing out that I was only making $15 a week along with all the hard labor was starting to bother me a little. I was here to do important work and be sent on vital missions, and more important, to wear heels, stockings, and a uniform with a cap, Navy style. I imagined myself clicking around the organization in my heels and yelling at people to clear the planet. But that just wasn't happening. It was right about that time that I noticed one of the kids from my sandcastle crew was wearing a uniform and was on post, meaning that he had a real Sea Org job that definitely was not cleaning toilets. "How the fuck did you get off the EPF?" I asked him. "You have to complete the courses and show up to study time," he replied. Nick and I had been taking the opportunity of study time to hide in the bathroom and take a nap in the tub, or take the hotel shuttle buses back and forth from the Fort Harris into the sandcastle, enjoying a break and some air conditioning. Up until this point, I was under the impression that my bad attitude was what was holding me back from moving on from the EPF. That once I had a more positive mindset, I would be magically rewarded, promoted, and assigned a uniform, and of course, the all-important heels. Nick and I quickly changed our ways and got on course. We wanted off of the EPF and soon. While I was making progress and heading in the right direction with my training, there was one thing I couldn't come to terms with. I thought a lot about my infant sister, Shannon, a sweet little blonde, blue-eyed thing. Whenever I could, I went to visit her in the nursery, where she stayed during the day while my mom was working. Nursery was a charitable term for the motel room in the Quality Inn filled with cribs of crying, neglected babies, flies, and the smell of dirty diapers. The only ventilation came from a huge fan by the window. This was where Sea Org members and staff dropped off their babies at 7 in the morning and then picked them up at 10 in the evening when their workday was over. We had an hour for lunch, but the shuttle took half an hour to go from Flag to the Quality Inn, so even if parents wanted to visit their children, they would have to